Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey there, welcome back to Origins, broadcasting from the Line Hotel here in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Today I'm very, very grateful to have Mike Curtin here, who I've gotten to know through his work at D.C. Central Kitchen. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, my brother.
So we started this conversation, I feel, a long time ago when you roped me into the battle.
Food fight? Yeah, capital food
exactly.
Fight?
And, you know, shame on me for not knowing more about DC Central Kitchen at that point. But since then, I feel, having gotten to know you and gotten to know the work that DC Central Kitchen does, just amazed at what you guys are able to pull off on a daily basis. And, you know, maybe on some level, this is a conversation I wish we didn't have to have about food that, you know, who gets to eat what in our world, but we certainly do have to have this conversation. And you guys are doing some of the most incredible work around that. So I know you're as busy as they come, so I really appreciate you making some time and getting over here. But I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
My pleasure, man. I really I appreciate the opportunity. We love talking about what we do. And I think you're right, Spike, that unfortunately people, it's easy to put us in a box, in an old, tired box of soup kitchens and pantries and charity. And what we're really trying to do is show that the incredible power that food has to create community change, to create economic development, and to elevate men and women out of poverty and to a place of self-sufficiency.
So let's talk about that, but let's start with maybe a little background about DC Central Kitchen for listeners that may not know the work that you're doing and how long you've been doing it.
Sure. Well, the kitchen has been around now going on 30 years. It was really started as a response to a confusing and disappointing and sort of unsatisfying volunteer experience our founder, Robert Egger, had feeding men and women on the streets of right in here in Washington, D.C. And he realized two very important things that night he went out reluctantly to hand out sandwiches and coffee. And one was that the men and women coming to this truck to get food had been coming night after night, week after week, month after month. And for all the group could tell, would continue that pattern. And so immediately he said, food's not going to end hunger. We'd been trying to feed our way out of hunger, and that will never happen. The other probably bigger and more powerful, and ultimately the piece that really informs our work every day, is that somehow this notion of charity, this almost uniquely American experiment of charity, accidentally, because people engaged in this are well-intentioned and have love in their hearts, but somehow this idea, particularly when it came to food, had been twisted so it was more about the redemption of the giver and not the liberation of the receiver. And so the kitchen was a place designed to be all about liberation, and again, using food as that liberating tool to create community, strengthen bodies, and empower minds.
So 30 years in, and you guys are feeding thousands of people a day?
Right. So right now, we're actually doing close to 13,000 meals a day. About 5,000 of those go to our community partners, whether they're shelters, transitional homes, halfway houses, or other agencies. And we're doing close to 8,000 locally sourced, scratch-cooked school meals now in D.C., mostly in Ward 7, east of the river. So for those who aren't aware, that's part of our city that is very much economically marginalized. So earning revenue, getting, again, out of that charity model, putting incredible food, locally sourced, so economic ripples into the rural economy, healthy food in areas that haven't seen it, and employing many of the men and women who graduate from our culinary job training program, who are individuals who have faced barriers to employment like incarceration, addiction, abuse, trauma, unemployment, and long-term homelessness.
Can you talk to me about how local sourcing got to be as big a part of what you do as it is? And I just want to say that kind of with the, because I'm amazed by it. And I know that there are many other institutions, because I've had these conversations, who have, who would love to do, say, what you're doing, but find reasons that they can't. And a lot of these institutions have a lot more resources than you probably do.
Well, what we have found, and just to your latter point there, that the easiest word to say, not only in the English language, but probably every language, is no, right? And that's you go no further. Your work is done when you say no. The kitchen has always been a place that wants to say yes, often to our detriment. We say yes first and figure it out later. That's what has sort of made us cool, sort of this rock and roll, Hunter S. Thompson, Keith Richards, seat of your pants kind of nonprofit. But we like to think we do it with a little bit of planning, certainly in the background. But so it's a really long story, and maybe that's for several other podcasts. But the long and short of it is, we had gone through, let's say, a negotiation discussion with the city regarding developing a contract to feed to provide food for the shelters. There was it took a long time. There was a significant delay getting the contract actually signed. We actually went on strike, which is something nonprofits probably don't do on a regular basis. Robert and I went on a fast. When we weren't serving food, we didn't eat either. This lasted 8 days, but we finally got our contract. And for the first time, we were actually able to buy food to supplement the food we were using, the donated surplus food we were using to provide meals for the shelters. And while we were incredibly proud of this work we had done, there was a day that we asked the question, where is this food that we are so proud of, that we've just gone through this pretty significant endeavor to obtain, where is this coming from? And this was back in 2006, so before local sourcing was really hip and cool, right? I'm sure you were doing it, my brother, but not everyone else.
Right, around the same time.
Everyone else hadn't caught up to you yet. And we found out that these particular tomatoes that we were looking at had actually come from Belgium. And we said, that's insane. What we were trying to do, again, was create economic empowerment, and these dollars that we had fought for were not only leaving our city, they were leaving our country. And so we said, we went back to the very beginning of DC Central Kitchen, and what we've always based our work on is use what's available, what other people have tossed aside, whether that's food, whether that's kitchens, whether that's people. And so we went to some of the growers that we had worked with. So at DuPont Circle Farmers Market is where we started, and who we had been gleaning from for years. So for years, we'd gone up to the market on Sunday. What they didn't sell, they didn't want to take back, we picked up and brought it back to the kitchen. That was awesome. But also, in many ways, the definition of unsustainable agriculture, giving away for free that which these growers toiled and worked hard to do. And so we said, what if this donation is great, but what if now we're buying food, why don't we buy it directly from you? And why don't we start by buying the product that's aesthetically or geometrically challenged in such a way that it has little or no commercial value, stuff that you've invested in, you've worked hard for, but you can't sell. And we're gonna take these tomatoes and we're gonna make it into a sauce. We're gonna take these cucumbers, we're gonna put it in a salad. We're gonna take these beans, whatever it is, we're gonna put it into something that will be healthy and fresh and delicious and appealing. And now creating revenue to farmers that the source of revenue, the stream that didn't exist, and that's expanded.
Do you remember the first thing that you bought that way? After that light bulb went off, and do you remember like going and saying like?
I remember one of the first things I remember is we got like 6 pallets of cabbage. And and for whatever reason, this was a time that was really, we had a lot of rain, okay? And so when the cabbage was peak picking time, I guess, the grower just couldn't get out to pick the cabbage. So these cabbage were the size of basketballs. The way I refer to them is they were two-handed cabbage. So when we go to a grocery store, we expect a one-handed cabbage. So we reach out, we pick with one hand, we move on. If we see a two-handed cabbage, our reaction, as Americans, typically is, oh, Chernobyl cabbage. Something's wrong. Something went off. Something's awry. This can't be what it's supposed to be. But it's perfect cabbage. It just doesn't fit in the box that has been manufactured to fit this many heads, as the way tomatoes are grown, that then fits in the say in the truck cab that's designed to fit this many boxes, and the bins at the grocery store who are designed to fit so many heads of cabbage, and so then the grocery store can hire knows how many people to hire to replenish that. So and we've gotten everything, but you know we got a bunch of sweet potatoes early on. Some the size of a football, some the size of a small tennis ball. Again, we want to employ people, so we have people to peel and to process these. We can engage our volunteer labor to do this, and we're just we're basically able to use just about everything in a way that benefits everyone, either nutritionally or economically.
So I love the word insane, the way you used it when looking at a case of tomatoes from Belgium, and just like I wish more people would maybe have that response or that reaction. So we go down that road, you get the giant cabbage, and now you're one of the biggest purchasers of local food. And I'll get off of this in a second, but I just love the fact that this is a big part of the way that you feed people and think about food. But now you're one of the biggest purchasers of local food in the area.
Absolutely, and certainly from the Shenandoah Valley Produce Auction, which is one of the first places. I had a chance encounter with someone actually at a restaurant association mixer, and I just started. I was so excited about this idea of doing this local purchasing. I would talk about it to anyone who'd listen. And it so happened that the guy that caught me two wines into this reception was a guy who worked for the Virginia Department of Agriculture. So he said, "I got a place we got to go. Meet me next Tuesday, and we're going down to Dayton, Virginia." And we went down, and it was like stepping into a time machine. It was phenomenal, and met a lot of the growers and told them what we wanted to do. I think they were wildly skeptical. But once we went to the first auction and bought more than they had ever seen any one group buy, and we paid our bill, that was a big thing right there. We became good friends. We had a buyer there this is a Mennonite co-op, I apologize, as it backtracks. So there's 450 growers that bring product to this auction. And what's been amazing, and this is when we've been able to see when people talk about the value of buying local. There are two stories I love to tell about this. One, at the end of most growing seasons, a lot of these growers will come up to D.C. Now, some of them can't get in, religious reasons, can't get in the car. Some of them can get in the car but can't drive. Some of them drive. So a group of them come up. And I was talking to one of the guys who was sort of the leader of the auction that year. And I said, "Dennis, I got to tell you, man, I can't thank you enough for believing in this idea and really changing the way we do business." And he looked at me and he said, "You got to be kidding me. This has changed our community. We now have a certainty in terms of what's going to happen at our auction." And over the years, other people have sort of caught on to this. And what's happened, it's about 4 or 5 years ago, they built a second auction barn that's much more efficient. It's sort of split in half and raised. So trucks, instead of the growers coming in on their tractors or their horse and buggies and unloading the stuff, the auctioneer walking around this big barn and then reloading the stuff, they line up in a field and drive their tractors right through the auction barn. The auctioneer hops on, and it's much more efficient. They've tripled the amount they're able to sell.
Wow.
So they're really efficiently using their land now in ways that they just weren't before. And it's just because we started something that other people are now following.
And are they?
I think so. We are no longer assured the number one position in their sales because others are coming in. So we're in the top 2, top 3. And that's cool too, because we've developed lots of other relationships with growers from southern Pennsylvania down to the valley. The deal has always been that it has to work for us and it has to work for the grower. And so we've developed some really cool relationships with folks who are doing contract growing. Because of our work with the schools, we'll know almost a year ahead of time exactly how many pounds of beans we need, how many pounds of squash, how many pounds of tomatoes, because these menus have to be approved by the USDA. And so we can go to growers and say, "Hey, we need 50,000 pounds of green beans. How much can you give me and at what rate?" And some growers want to work that way, some don't. We have a couple. We have a grower that has 2 acres of corn that we buy it all, and then we vacuum seal, freeze it when it's in season, and pull it out and use it over the course of the school year.
When are you guys having these conversations with growers?
Well, I honestly, I think pretty much year round. Mm-hmm. I think we really at the end of the school at we'll really start at the beginning of the year, end of the growing, you know, into right after, right in January, February.
Right.
And we have 2 people now on staff that they're a procurement team. And so they are always constantly dealing with the growers, and developing new relationships, but working on the future. So, you know, we have new menu items, our new contract, our first step is going out to the growers.
Do you have any numbers around the local purchasing you're doing?
We're doing roughly about £500,000 a year. And that's translating into, you know, between $450,000 and $550,000. We're doing about £500,000.
And all this is fresh produce.
This is all fresh. Now, and we're also doing some dairy. This is the produce numbers we're talking about. We are doing some dairy. We are doing some protein, but the majority of it is produce. But we're looking everywhere. We, by contract, for our DC Public Schools contract, 20%, I think it's 20% of our buy has to be local. We're doing well over 30% of our buy, but we've also set an internal goal that at least 50% of the plate every day of the 6 components has to be local, regardless of the time of the year.
Wow!
And we're exceeding that. We've never not hit or exceeded that.
Do you guys do a lot of, so to kind of maintain that? Is there a lot of processing that happens? You mentioned corn that gets frozen. How much of your work at the kitchen is around that?
A good amount in a short period of time. So what's really cool, actually, and from a labor perspective, and our job is. One of our mission parts is to create careers, and mostly for men and women who have not had access to these opportunities. So one of the downsides often of the food industry is it can be part-time, it can be sporadic, it can be seasonal. So when we were hiring folks for our schoolwork, we didn't want to say, you got a great job for 9 months. The rest of it, you're on your own. So what we've been able to do because of the different lines of business and the processing is we can have folks that work in the schools basically end of August to end of June. And if they want to continue over the summer, they basically move into processing because that's when, as you know, that's when all the stuff is coming in. End of June is when it really starts. And then folks who are working in the other kitchens can take some time off. We rotate people in and we tend to be very busy with volunteers during the summer. So during those peak harvest times, we're bringing in, you know, the volunteers, extra staff to do that processing, vacuum sealing and freezing. And this is, this is the reason why the USDA has certified us as the only permanent food hub in the District of Columbia, because of the volume of product we're bringing in, processing and putting back into the community.
What does that certification mean?
It means that the USDA has recognized our work in terms of as a food hub creating economic opportunity from rural communities to urban communities. It's something that's pretty cool, and I think this is an interesting thing that we talk about often is that food hubs have become big, right? There's conferences now, there's all sorts of stuff. We didn't set out to be a food hub. Quite honestly, we didn't even know that we had been certified a food hub. It's not something we applied for, that we said, hey, if we get this, this is really going to do something for us. But I think what it does do for us is it shows, our commitment to the local economy. But I think it also shows our creativity as a social enterprise as opposed to just a straight nonprofit or what one would typically think of as a nonprofit that feeds men and women. This is what we've tried to do is, again, look at this creatively and create an innovative business model that, again, can be replicated in different places around the country.
So I want to transition away from the food, as hard as that is for me to do. But I've gotten to spend some time at the kitchen and traveled around, saw some of your schools. And so impressed by the people you have working for you, some of the culinary professionals, the chefs that are kind of running the show in the kitchens. But then And they're just as passionate about what they do as any chef I've ever met. And obviously doing it in this way that supports growers, but also supports the mission.
Well, you know what's interesting, Spike, and I'm a recovering restaurateur myself.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, had I been as successful as you, I may have continued that work instead of doing this. So I'm glad I wasn't. But as I say often, I did own my own restaurant for about 5 years in Falls Church, and that was my first experience in the nonprofit sector. So I've worked in kitchens and restaurants for a long time. And oftentimes when I tell people what I do or some friends are just asking me about it, one of the awkward kind of questions I get is when I'm so proud to say that half of our staff are graduates of our training program. Again, formerly incarcerated people, folks that have battled addiction, people that have been abused. And people will sort of stammer through somehow asking, isn't it hard working with that group of people? And my answer, honestly and quickly, has always been, actually, the folks that we work with, I have found to be the most dependable, reliable, trustworthy individuals that I've ever worked with. And it's mostly, I believe, because there's a really, really deep understanding of the value of a job. And people that have been in places that they don't want to go back to, and really want to become role models for their families, for their children, and are really proud to be part of something bigger. And so there is this commitment to the work, throughout the organization, but at the schools is really remarkable. There's a story that, just one quick story, there was this happened, I guess, 2 years ago. We had a food service, one of our cooks in the school is Desiree. This was an elementary school over in Ward 7. And she noticed that there was one girl in particular, and this is the beauty, they get to know the students. It's not just a job. They're really invested in their kids, as they say. She noticed that there's one particular girl who never made it on time for breakfast. And what people say, breakfast being the most important meal of the day, it's true. We see it every day. And the kids, their performance, their behavior, teachers will tell you. And so we take great pride in doing these hot breakfasts every day. And so this young woman, this young girl, she's a second grader, would sneak into the cafeteria and Desiree would try to get her some food. And, you know, she finally asked her, she goes, why can't you make it? And this young girl said, well, usually there's no one home. And if there is, no one gets me up to go to school. And that is tragic. So Desiree, our food service worker, who had faced immense barriers of her own, took it upon herself without telling anyone, without talking to anyone, and this was right around the holidays, went to the CVS and bought this girl an alarm clock as a holiday gift. And this girl started showing up to breakfast and looked different. She acted different. She did better in school. Now, I would love to tell you now, actually this is more, I think this was 4 years ago. I would like to tell you now that she's now president of the student council. I don't know this, but I do know that that connection will forever change both of those individuals. And that, again, can't say it too often, is the power of food, the connection that it makes and the community that it can build when people are invested in what it actually does.
It totally brings to mind, for me, just what we ask of our kids when they're not fed, when they're not well fed. And it seems like in cities like D.C. and unfortunately like cities like Baltimore, we ask that way too often.
Yeah, it's just wrong. And this is where the kitchen started in many ways years ago. And we said, how can we be in this incredibly wealthy country, in this wealthy city within this wealthy country, where we're throwing away close to 40% of the food that we manufacture and a fourth of the people who live in this city, the nation's capital, don't know where their next meal is coming from, where we have some of the, especially east of the river, we have some of the highest rates of childhood obesity and childhood hunger, highest rates of food insecurity, health-related, diet-related diseases. That's criminal. So there's absolutely something wrong about that, and we in our small way, we're not going to fix that problem, but we hope to be on a small level modeling what's possible if we all think about this a little differently.
Conversely, my favorite moment when I was in one of your schools was a little girl that came up to the salad bar, which you had there, which was beautiful, and she was like, oh, I feel like a salad today. And that to me was like not only the fact that she's going to get to eat this amazing salad of her own devising because you had all this great produce there, but her behavior was, I mean, indicated that that was nothing, no big deal for her. Like, right. You know, maybe it's a salad day today.
Right. But at one point it was a big deal, right?
Right.
And so this is what we know, and we've seen it. We've been in the DC public schools now for 8 years. We've been doing school food for a total of 10. We started in one school in 2008. That over time, behaviors, expectations change. Certainly, it's with everything. And one of the things that we fought going into this project, and again, not uncommon in things that we have fought before in general around other initiatives that we've taken, is sort of this notion that poor people aren't interested in healthy food. Those kids won't eat healthy food. Don't bother. Well, the response, of course, is, well, if you don't feed it to them, you will be right 100% of the time, right? No one is going to eat anything they are not fed. It's just like when we started doing acting as a wholesaler of healthy produce and healthy snacks and food to corner stores in the city's food deserts. And people said, well, people in those neighborhoods aren't going to buy healthy food. Well, if it's not there, yes, they will not buy that. No one in the history of the world has ever bought anything that is not available. But we have proven that these students, kids across the board will eat healthy food if that's what they're given and if it's served with love and dignity and respect and a bit of understanding. And we're seeing fresh produce fly off the shelves in these corner stores that before this only had processed snack food and lottery tickets and cigarettes. There's a market for it. We just had to prove that there was.
Given everything you know about the way people eat and you know some of the numbers that you just cited, let me ask you this. Is good food a right in a country like ours?
I think it has to be. That there's... When you look at almost anything that is so starkly stratified by race and economic standing, clearly there's something wrong, and until we get to a place where that says everyone should have a seat at this table, everyone should have an equal seat at this table, equal access to this table, we're not really going to get anywhere. And I think what's also interesting is that with food, it's like the easiest hurdle to jump over. We have enough of it. There's plenty of it. We just need to be more purposeful and thoughtful about getting to it and getting it to people. That's really there's not a lack of desire. There's not a lack of demand. There's not a lack of supply. What's missing is that distribution piece in the middle. Some of our internal mechanisms that we use to provide support for those who may not be able to purchase, don't have access to a Whole Foods or even a full service grocery store. So one of the things that I mentioned the Healthy Corners program. That's the one where we're doing fruits and vegetables. So we just applied for a while ago, but we're just notified, and it's been announced publicly now that we are the recipient of a USDA food nutrition, Finney grant, food nutrition initiative, where we will use a significant amount of money from the USDA over 3 years to double SNAP dollars for produce at corner stores. So this doubling program has been available at some markets, at some farmers markets, which is awesome. But unfortunately, farmers markets are not available everywhere. They're not available every day. They're not available every month. They're not available 24 hours a day. And some of these corner stores are. And so we've been working really hard in sort of fighting to get that opportunity in corner stores. And I think, again, with the ultimate goal of proving the market so other retailers can move in and say, I guess there's an opportunity here. And then we move aside.
What I love about those doubling programs is that they can do, they do so much good in so many different ways. And specifically, you double the spending power that, that an individual has, and then you double those dollars that are going back to growers if they're, you know, if we're able to keep them local. And you've got, I think, the very definition of win-win.
Well, and another win, there's then the retailers. They're getting reimbursed for that. So their sales are doubling. So that's huge for some of these mom and pops. And then you think about the fact that we're processing mango, pineapple, melon. So we're slicing, boxing, packaging. So there's a job, or two jobs, or three jobs. And then there's the person on our end who's the sales and delivery rep. So there's another job. So there's huge amounts of economy that come from this, far more than just the dollar exchange, the dollars exchange at the stores.
Why do you think it's been such a struggle for us, I think, as a society to understand the manifold benefits of this kind of thinking when it comes to food, which is what we're talking about right now, as opposed to that, you know, going back to that insane tomato from Belgium?
Right. Well, I guess... I think there's a couple things. All right,
I'm going to try to find a question that you have trouble answering because you're so good with this. But I think I'm getting close.
Well, there's a couple of things. I think that what we really need to do, and the hardest thing to do, is to change hearts and minds of people that already have access to these things that we're talking about. And unfortunately, a lot of people that do have that access can't imagine that others wouldn't. And what's even more discouraging, and we're going to get a little deep here, Spike, if you don't mind.
We're all about it.
Is that what's more discouraging is that there's still, and one might even argue that today this is growing a little bit, this sentiment that exists that people think if someone can't afford fresh fruits and vegetables, if someone doesn't live in a neighborhood that has a grocery store, if someone is hungry, if someone can't put healthy food on the table for their kids, it's their own damn problem because they're lazy. If they really wanted to, they could. And that is just not true. We see it every day, and we see it starkly. We see it here again in our nation's capital. Where we are is a tremendous part of town right here in Northwest Washington, D.C. 3 miles in Southeast D.C. or across the Anacostia River, it might as well be a different country. And the experiences that individuals have growing up, based on where you are, your economic status, and your race, have a dramatic impact on what you will do, what opportunities you have into the future. So this notion of the American dream as if it's some sort of commodity that sits on a shelf in the American Dream store and anyone can walk in and say, I want some American dream, please. And if you don't ask for that or get it, then it's your own damn fault. Crazy. So we have to awake people to the others, our society, community, to the notion that there is systemic inequality. It doesn't mean that by naming it, I've created it, that I'm responsible for it, that somehow I'm guilty of that. But I do believe if I don't name it, I know that I'm not going to be able to do anything about it, and then I'm guilty of that. So I think there's this larger awareness piece that we really have to get to say, you know, it's just not as fair as people want, because you know what, damn it, it should be, right? It should be. And so it goes against what we want to admit that this is not all that it should be. We can be better.
Is there a crisis in our food system? Are you describing a crisis in our food system?
Sure. If you think about it, if you think about how we want to be as Americans, if you think about what we have done, you think about the assembly line, the efficiencies that we've created, and if you think about the efficiencies that the food system even has created in terms of the grains and soy and what we have done basically at the end of World War II when we had all this food and we said, well, what the hell are we going to do with this now? And we said, oh, we'll process it and put it in TV dinners and we'll make a microwave so we can do that and we can have all... And
right, we'll change the way the farms work.
All of that, and I want to be careful because all of that isn't necessarily bad. There have been some things that have happened because of science and because of technology. And there's this really weird, this sort of tension, especially within the nonprofit sector. You know, one could say that, you know, with the evolution, and again, I don't want to say processed food is good, but when you come up with ways that, and again, this is going to sound sort of sexist, but this is the way our country was. If, you know, when you can have ways that meals can be created for families without someone, typically the wife or the mother or the woman, staying at home and cooking for 5 or 6 hours, if that can be eliminated or simply reduced, there's a lot more opportunity for everyone to get into the workforce. And when a lot of women went into the workforce, they went into education and they went into nonprofits. So a lot of the work that we do now was enabled by this mechanization, scientification of the food system, without thinking about these dangerous, dangerous repercussions that we are now dealing with in terms of the environment, in terms of health.
Yes.
So to think that if we can do all of that, certainly we should be able to create a system where people can have an apple or an orange or a banana or a grape and not have to walk 2.5-3 miles to get it, and it's cost prohibitive. It should be accessible. So in that sense, I think it's a crisis of innovation, of will, to say, can't we really do better about this? You know, we certainly should be able to do better.
And I think I might have to leave it at that. I think you're right. There are several podcasts worth of things for us to talk about. But I really appreciate you coming in here and talking about DC Central Kitchen. You're listening to Origins on Full Service Radio, broadcasting from the Line Hotel, Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.